Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, the search for the missing Titanic submersible has entered its fourth day, and with more deep sea vehicles being sent as part of this international rescue, we have the latest news from Newfoundland from CBC reporter Ryan Cook. Ryan, good morning to you and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the latest? We've heard about new machinery. This French research vessel, L'Atlante, has been employed, and more banging noises.
Yes, so the banging noises continued throughout yesterday, and there's still no word on what those were or a confirmation on whether or not they believe that those are man-made noises. But as you mentioned, another ROV reaching the scene this morning, actually two ROVs reaching the scene this morning. The Newfoundland vessel Horizon Arctic has also reached the scene with its Odysseus 6K ROV. Both of these machines have the ability to dive to the full depth of the Titanic, and they're hanging a lot of hope on these. Our French colleagues at CBC have spoken with those close to Paul-Henri Nargeolet this morning, who say they still have hope because the best equipment in the world is being deployed, but obviously the clock is running out.
And how long do we have on that, Ryan? What's the estimated oxygen time remaining for the Titan submersible?
So some estimates based on what the Coast Guard had told us on Tuesday would peg the clock hitting zero in about 1 hour. So the time is really, really, really running low now. We've spoken with some experts this morning, though, here in Newfoundland, some hyperbaric medicine specialists who say that the conditions inside of the sub and in the cold water out around it could prolong their oxygen supply a bit longer. It's an unfortunate circumstance, however, because they would have to be pretty much hypothermic to reduce their oxygen levels, and that could stretch out that oxygen supply a little bit further, but obviously further endangering their lives as well. The water down there is right near the freezing point, and if they've lost electricity in the sub, there would be no way to heat the sub. So that is obviously one of the big risks that they're facing right now. But it's interesting that on the flip side of that, it could also prolong that oxygen supply.
And what are you hearing about why it has taken this length of time to locate the source of the banging noise? What are the challenges being encountered by this rescue or possibly recovery operation?
One of the big challenges right now is that there's a lot of equipment in the area. So locating the source of that banging noise, you'd have to rule out every other vessel and ROV that is working in the area. So as we heard yesterday from one of the experts that the Coast Guard put forward, there's just a lot of noise in the ocean. Some of it is man-made, some of it is biological, some of it is natural. So they have to sort through a whole mess of noise to try and figure out what could be coming from this vessel if it is indeed still intact and if the members are trying to reach out.
Right. Who's leading the operation? Because, those challenges that you're talking about may be mitigated at least by a level of coordination. So who's the lead agency on this coordinating all the activity?
The lead agency right now is the United States Coast Guard operating out of Boston, their Northeast Division, and they've set up what they call a unified command. So they're working in tandem with the U.S. Navy, the Canadian Coast Guard, the Canadian Royal Navy, and they brought in some experts from France and from the U.K. yesterday as well to aid in that coordination. It's a huge search effort. It's something that we have never seen off the coast of Newfoundland, and we have seen our share of nautical disasters, and I don't think we've seen something with this scale, with this many different agencies involved.
And when, notwithstanding the potential for people lasting longer in colder temperatures, what's the estimated time at which this really will change from a rescue operation into a recovery operation today?
We're expecting to hear from the Coast Guard this afternoon at about 2:30 Newfoundland time. Forgive me, I think that would be about 6 o'clock your time. And at that point, the big question will be, has this turned from a rescue into a recovery?
All right, Ryan, thank you very much for joining us. Well, a little earlier today, I spoke to Oisin Fanning. He's CEO of San Leon Energy PLC. He's taken two dives with the OceanGate Titan submersible in the last year to see the Titanic, and many people will have seen newspaper photos of the vessel. It looks to be like a tiny minivan. I began by asking him what it's like to be on board the small vessel.
It's like a big round cigar tube, to be honest. It's very simple. There are no seats. Five people fit in. One is the pilot up in front. He works off a couple of joysticks and a computer. And basically, the rest of you are inside, and you've the porthole at the front, and you can, two or three of you can sit there at the same time and look out when you reach your destination.
So you're just sitting on the floor, are you?
Yeah, you are. But designed to be basic for that very reason. You know, lightness, sturdiness, obviously, is very, very strong because it has to be to go down to those depths and pressures, you know, 6,000 square feet per inch. It's it's huge pressure, and at 4,000 meters, you know, you need nice strong composites, and so keep it simple is the answer.
So the Titanic is resting 3,800 meters below the surface, and you begin the drop in this very small vessel. How long does it take?
It takes between 3 and 4 hours. You go down under your own steam, not by motors or anything. You just basically have weights. And basically, you spiral down slowly until you reach the bottom between 3,800 and 4,000 metres.
And the speed at which you're going down, that's to adjust for the pressure, is it? Not to do it too suddenly?
Not particularly, no, because the pressure's intact inside the vessel no matter what. So that doesn't have any bearing. But because you're going down under your own weight at your own speed, it's about, I think, about 30 metres a minute, something like that. But maybe it's even a second, but it's relatively slow. You don't get any feeling of speed anyway, either way.
And we've heard people who go down who, before you even get on board, and presumably when you apply for this, you sign a waiver, and the possibility of death is mentioned three times in the first page. So it's pretty apparent what the risks are.
Yeah, of course it is. It's as apparent as it is if you're going into space. If you're driving a Formula One car, if you're doing anything risky, nowadays insurance companies make sure there's three. I mean, I'm surprised it's not mentioned more than three. But, you know, any waiver you sign in this day and age makes it very clear there's risk of death, injury, or permanent injury, etc. Very clear.
And does it make explicit why those risks exist? Is it that you could run out of oxygen? Is it that you could be incommunicado? Is it that something might go wrong with the vessel? Or does it just say death is a possibility?
No. I mean, it doesn't go into those specific details, but it's self-evident. Anyone who's going down to 6,000 metres, 4,000 metres at least, is very well aware all these things are possibilities. And it's made quite clear to you a year before you even dive, like, you're getting Zoom calls and lectures, etc., all the way through the year. And then when you arrive on the boat, it takes 2 days to get out there. You're given safety briefings and again, lectures twice a day. So, you know, everybody's very familiar with the potential risks.
And how do they determine the safety from their own point of view? I mean, do they test you in confined spaces to see how you cope so that, you know, they know before you get in that you're not going to freak out 2 hours from the bottom when you might be out of communication?
Trust me, if you're in any way claustrophobic, nobody's getting in there in the first place. So I think it's fairly, fairly safe. They're fairly safe that no one's going to freak out anywhere. Towards the bottom, this is quite tight. You have to climb over each other to move to different places. You know, anybody who's claustrophobic, and I have met people who have considered the dive and were slightly claustrophobic, just went, "Oh God, no, I can't do it." You know, so it's not going to happen.
And were you aware of the 2018 court case where safety concerns had been outlined, as the New York Times is reporting now? Had you seen that?
No, I wasn't. But I mean, like, honestly, it would be fairly obvious that any employee taking a sort of a case against an employer is hardly going to be saying anything nice about that particular company. Wouldn't have concerned me at all. There's no question here that the composites are, that'd be like a Formula One team pointing at the other Formula One team saying, "We think their carbon fiber is slightly weaker than ours." Like, at the end of the day, really. I attach no importance to that whatsoever, and I wouldn't have had I known about it beforehand.
And so, when they eventually close the hatch and bolt it in place, what's the feeling like?
Well, I mean, you're excited because you're looking forward to finally getting underway. It takes so many hours to get underway. They're up from 4 o'clock in the morning. You mightn't get underway till 9 o'clock, maybe even 10 o'clock. I mean, there are so many stops and starts to check everything and recheck everything again and go back and check. And it's all done in what they call stop skis, just like you do for space. And you might have 7 or 8 of those. So quite frankly, when that hatch shuts and you're going towards the sea, you're just thrilled to get down underwater and get underway.
And what do you see on your way down? And eventually then, when you get to the wreckage of the Titanic, what can you see in the dark down there?
Yeah, well, for the first few hundred metres, you still have light. Then you go into this area between, say, 500 metres and 1,000 metres, where you see all these sort of shrimp and different things flashing at you, which is amazing. You know, you just see thousands of different fish and shrimp flashing at you as you see anglerfish or whatever it might be. Then it's total darkness, and then you hit the bottom. You turn on your lights. We were very fortunate when we landed the first time. We were 120 metres away from the bow. We literally turned on our two tiny thrusters, went up the bow, and was just literally, you know, hovering just, you know, a couple of feet above the bow.
And do you go?
Just spent 4 hours on the ship.
And you go into the wreckage itself, do you? Weaving
no.
in and out of, you don't, okay.
No, you're not. You're above it, the side of it. You don't go anywhere near where you could actually touch anything as such, because they're even concerned that there are these things called rusticles, which they didn't expect on the ship, which is a new form of bacteria which is eating away at the ship. And they're even concerned if you went too close, you'd knock one of those off. I mean, they're light, but just to keep the integrity of the ship intact, there's no chance you go near any too close so that you could knock anything.
So what's it like going around the Titanic with the light on this submersible, seeing it for the first time?
Well, it's surreal. It's amazing. You're seeing things like lights still on walls 110 years later, a bath poking out of a door. You see plates on the ground, not on the ship as such, but to the side of the ship. You know, I mean, there's so much to see. You can see the gymnasium. You can see the walkway. A lot of the wood has collapsed in, obviously, over the years. In fact, there hasn't been up until the year before last, there's been no dives in the Titanic for 16 years. So one of the reasons for the dives actually was to see how it had deteriorated over those 16 years. No, but it is fascinating. But also very well aware it's a gravesite too. I mean, we hold a ceremony up above. We throw flowers into the sea, etc., and say some prayers. So, you know, it's tinged with a mix of excitement and sadness at the same time.
And what drew you to doing it?
Well, my father was from Derry. He lived a good part of his life in Belfast. So I grew up hearing stories about, you know, Harland and Wolff, the Titanic, etc., as a child, always fascinated. In fact, 16 years ago, I actually applied. It was a lottery to get the last seat on a sub. It was a different sub. It was a Russian sub. But I applied, didn't get the lottery. And then when I saw Oceangate come up, I applied immediately.
So tell us about the guys behind it, Paul Narjoulet and Stockton Rush. You've met them, you know them. You're obviously worried for their safety.
I've dived with them, actually, so I'm very worried about them, yeah. Paul Narjoulet was a commander in the French Navy. He then subsequently went on to manage all the French, basically, submersibles. So he's very, very knowledgeable. He was very heavily involved in finding the Titanic and then actually going and taking some of the big pieces of steel and metal that you now see in the Titanic Museum, etc., up from the seabed. So he's been breathing the Titanic and undersea operations all his life. So he's been doing that constantly. So, like, he's had, I think on this sub alone, he's had something like 40 dives to the Titanic. And in fact, he and I and Stockton did a dive where last year we found a volcanic reef, an unknown volcanic reef about a day away from the Titanic, which very kindly they named the Narjoulet after Paul and Narjoulet Banning Reef because it was unknown to science. And it had 2,000-year-old sponges and corals, etc. on it. So that was as fascinating as going to the Titanic, to be honest.
And what kind of guys are they, personally?
Solid, nice guys. You know, obviously nice individuals, very affable. They're both very, very solid. I mean, these guys would not be panicking. These guys would have immediately realised if they were caught on something, that's what we're hoping and guessing. If they were caught on something, they'd know immediately to conserve oxygen, conserve their breathing, don't panic, don't breathe too heavily. I believe the two businessmen and one of the businessmen's son that are down there, they're two apparently billionaires. They didn't get there by being panickers either. So I'm sure they will have listened very carefully, and I'm hoping that they will have a lot more oxygen than people expect.
Right. Well, some people may have seen videos of the interior, the preparation for the dive. I saw one light fixture from the inside was the Stockton Rush was saying had been bought in Camp Store, and the controller for it looks like something for a PlayStation. I mean, does that give any concern, the sort of almost DIY aspect of the inside of it?
No, because, like, I mean, you got to realize what. So what is this little, which I used, by the way, and steered myself? They gave it to all of us to use. What is it controlling? It's controlling two tiny thrusters to move you around the ship. That's all. So it doesn't need to be anything complicated. It doesn't go up and down under any engine. It goes down by its own weight. Then literally you cast away some weight to get negative buoyancy or neutral buoyancy, and then basically the two little thrusters bring you all around the Titanic or all around the area. But then when you want to go up, you drop more weight and you just head on up and take, well, roughly 3.5 hours to get back up.
All right, so everybody on board gets a go on driving, do they?
We did, yeah. I mean, it is as simple as using Nintendo, you know, when you're down there. It's very, very easy to use. It's you know, this is nothing powerful. It's just something that you know, sort of you mosey along above the Titanic and around it, etc. And, you know, it's anyone could do it.
And are you walked through safety protocols? I mean, we've heard stories of knocking, and you've mentioned, you know, not panicking and trying to conserve oxygen with your breathing, and presumably not to generate too much carbon dioxide either. But what kind of a safety lecture or briefing do you get beforehand?
Well, you get plenty. I mean, as I was saying to you, I mean, you have Zoom calls all year round before you even go. Then you have 2 days of it nonstop on the ship, and like truly impatient clients, you're actually thinking it's too much, but of course it isn't. It's necessary. And so you get plenty of briefs. And, of course, you always have two senior people down with you. There are only three clients, and there are two staff members. In this case, honestly, if I was stuck, I couldn't think of two better people to be stuck with. They've years of experience. So that those two gentlemen know exactly what they need to do, and they will instruct you what to do. So you're reliant on that as well, as much as the briefings that you get.
Right. In 1 hour, 45 minutes into this dive, they lost communications. But you lost communications on your dive as well, did you?
I think that's an exaggeration. What I actually stated yesterday was that actually, you know, there would be moments, as in seconds, where obviously you're going through water, 12,000 feet of water, whereby, of course, you might lose it for 10 seconds or 30 seconds, but then get it back just like you would on any radio and even on Earth. So that headline was that you may be referring to is complete exaggeration. It was simply that, yeah, of course you have blips. You're 12,000 feet down. So you're going to have blips on where it's fuzzy or you can't hear it. But there was never any catastrophic loss, and not even for more than, you know, 10 or 20 seconds.
All right. Well, the loss, or the fact that this vessel is missing, the Ocean Gate is missing, is going to put a focus on underwater tourism and these kinds of trips. Do you think that's justified? Do you think there's a rethink needed?
I don't know. No more so than if something goes wrong in space. You know, I mean, our planet has not been observed properly. We know this. I mean, it's an unknown quantity of the sea. It's not just for tourism. The second dive that we made was actually an anomaly we saw, and it turned out to be a big volcanic reef. Full of vent holes, full of sponges, full of corals. Nobody knew that was there. Nobody knew it was there to be studied. Now they do. So, you know, our sea is like 75%+ of it is undiscovered. It's going to continue to be exploration. Not necessarily tourist exploration, but exploration.
All right. Oisin Fanning, CEO of San Leon Energy PLC, who's taken two dives on the Ocean Gate Titan submersible. Thanks for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.